You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, October 27th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
And we have a special guest this week, Richard Wiseman. Richard, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Bonjour, ça va?
You are the host, the MC
of yes.
SciCon 2012.
Yes.
2012.
2012. And we do doing an excellent job.
Thank you.
Enjoying it very much. And thanks again for joining us on the show. So we were chatting a while ago about your recent work that you've been doing. You're working on something to do with dreams.
I am. I'm working on Dream On, which is an iPhone app which everyone can download because it's free. Mm-hmm. And it's an idea that came to me, I guess, about a year and a half ago when I looked at some very bizarre research from, I think it was the early 70s, from Stanford, I think it was. And it was a guy who was waiting until people were in dream state. He was a sleep researcher.
It's LaBerge?
No. It's William Demet.
And we should mention before you go in that you are a psychologist.
We should mention that.
Yes.
Yes. Shall we?
Yes.
And let's mention that. I'm a psychologist.
And author of several books. You'd like to
The books. Paranormality. Mm-hmm. That's very good. They very kindly gave me a little prize for that at this very conference.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's very nice.
A very prestigious prize,
Prestigious prize. Yeah. Robert Bales, Critical Thinking.
Yeah, you're following the footsteps of some very
I understand the previous recipient is not very far from me now.
That's right.
Did it change your life?
Oh, tremendously, yes. Yes. It altered the trajectory of my life in numerous ways.
But I tell you what's nice is the money that comes with it.
$10,000.
Lovely.
dollars or euros? Or lira?
Anyway.
Yen.
So, yes, I'm a psychologist, and I got interested in dreaming because of Paranormality, actually.
Yes.
There's a chapter on precognitive dreams. So I got into the work of a guy called William Demet, and he did this great experiment, best experiment ever. So he, in a sleep research lab, he waited until people were in dream state, and showing REM and rapid eye movement, and then he played in audio sounds as audio soundtracks tend to be,
non-audio sounds.
As opposed to those audio visual images, and of things like a steam train for about 20 seconds, and then he woke people up, and they were dreaming about, you know, they'd incorporated the sound into their dream.
Yeah.
And it's about 50% of people he got this effect on. So I read about that, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could take that and roll it out on the iPhone and influence the whole world's dreams?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to an iPhone company, and they said, that's insanely difficult, but they were prepared to try it. And we worked for a year. And basically, you take your iPhone at night. Before you go to bed, you decide what time you want to wake up. And then you put it on your mattress next to you, and it monitors movement in the half an hour, 30 minutes before you wake up. It monitors movement very, very closely. And when it feels that you're very maximally still, i.e. dreaming, because you're paralyzed when you dream, it plays in the soundscape of your choice. Could be walking on a beach, could be out in nature, could be on an aeroplane. And that influences your dream. It wakes you up in a nice, gentle way, and then you're asked to report your dream into our dream bank. Called the Dream Catcher.
The Dream Catcher.
Oh, that's very clever.
Yeah. It's good, isn't it? Eh?
Yeah, that's good.
So we rolled that out, and we currently, I just checked last week, we currently have 10 million dream reports.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Isn't that scary? And the main finding is that when people wake up in the mornings and type in, they can't spell. but it's lovely. It's lovely. And it doesn't work with everyone by any means. We're still changing the algorithms on it because we can do that remotely. It's very scary what you can do on iPhone.
Yeah.
So every time you log in your iPhone, we send you a different algorithm, but you don't know it. And we get the data back and so on. And for some people, it works very, very well. So we have people who are sort of almost addicted to it. So there's one woman whose dreams I read actually almost every morning because she's having a long-term affair with George Clooney. In her dreams.
In her dream.
And she met him in Walmart, not for real, in her dream, about a month ago. And now she dreams about him every night using the dreamscapes.
So really, this whole app was launched because you're just a really creepy voyeur.
Yeah. Pretty much, yes.
that is also true,
yeah. But it's incidental. But so we've got a new dreamscape coming out this very week. I've completely lost track of time, so I think it's coming out either the next couple of days or a couple of days after that, because we asked people, what dream would you most like to have? And we asked guys, and the answer was, we want to be part of a zombie attack.
Really?
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
Awesome. Now, which side of the fence, though?
As a human.
Okay.
So we have a very well-known
living human.
Yep. As we have a well-known news reader who is reading out this sort of news, and then suddenly there's a zombie attack, and he takes you through how to kill all the zombies. So that's going to be the latest dreamscape, and then we're going to premium dreamscapes and later on in the year, which basically are sexually oriented. so you can have intercourse, as I refer to it as a psychologist, with celebrities. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is your app going to make people dream those things?
Voiceover artists.
So it's going to basically be like, hey, this is J-Lo. We're getting it on.
Yeah. Right? I'm doing the Elvis one.
Awesome. Yeah. Are you doing all dead celebrities so you can avoid
precisely.
Very good. So that was my next question.
Here we go. What?
Wow, that nailed it.
So
I'll tell you.
I'm getting a little hard.
Richard, in Nashville.
That's the first thing that Elvis says.
Very little.
And then 5 minutes later, he goes, oh.
No, he only goes, because that's all I can do.
Okay.
So that's the full extent of it. So it's a rather limited sexual dream. So that's what I'm doing at the minute. I love it. I love messing around with all these things.
Richard, cool that reminds stuff. Me, I remember reading research, I think it was Stephen LeBarge, who was studying lucid dreaming and how to induce lucid dreams. He came up with a dream light, which created these visual images having to do with sight.
Yep.
As opposed to the ones that don't. And so basically it determines when you're in REM sleep, it produces a light. And if you're going to sleep, you know that if you see a blue light, then that means you're dreaming. So you actually will see the blue light in the dream. And then you know this is a dream, and then hopefully become lucid and get some sort of control.
Well, you can easily add a lucid track to say you are dreaming.
Correct. That's what we do. Yes. We have those. Lucid dreaming is so hard to do. But if you use the tracks a lot, then the gentle voice whispers, you're now dreaming, you take control of it.
I'm going to try that.
So it's kind of cool. We had a bit to do with Stephen, who's a big lucid dreamer, trying to develop these things. And I didn't know this about lucid dreams. It's so real to them. They have to do things to see whether or not they're lucid.
Yes.
Reality test. So one of the things is looking into a mirror. Because if you look into a mirror, you won't see your own reflection in a lucid dream.
Really?
I think because the cognitive architecture to produce an image is too much for the brain. So that seems to be their number one test, is you look into a mirror.
I'm familiar with two other ones.
To clarify, when they're awake,
yep.
they do these things to make sure they're not lucid dreaming.
No, when they're dreaming, because they can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
So when they're awake, they would do it because they think, oh, I might be dreaming, and then see the reflection and think, no, this is reality. I better not jump out of the
building. That's odd. I mean, I could see
not knowing if you're
dreaming, not knowing if you're dreaming or not. But when you're awake, really, they can't
tell. No, Steve, you're training yourself because if you do it enough, it becomes a habit, and then you'll do it in your dream.
Right. That's the whole idea.
You're conditioning yourself to do it while you're dreaming.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to clarify. So they're not looking in the mirror while they're awake to make sure that they're really awake.
Well, they would be, because otherwise, if they knew they were dreaming, there'd be no point in looking in the mirror. It'd be a tautology.
Right.
Yeah, I understand. So they're talking about something different than what you're talking about.
Okay.
They're talking about training yourself to do something when you're awake so that you'll do it in your dream, and that will enable you to achieve a lucid state.
No.
You're talking about when they're awake, they're like, hey, am I really awake or is this a lucid dream? And they look in the mirror to check themselves.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, that seems amazing to me.
What I've learned with lucid dreaming is that you get in the habit of asking yourself, am I awake or am I dreaming right now? How do I know I'm not? And the two ways that I've read about is one is to read. Open a book, read anything. And invariably, in a dream, if you read something and look away and then look back, the words will change and be jumbled up. And I've done it many times. And it works every time. The words always change. And the other way to test it is to test physics, really. You jump up in the air and you try to extend your fall. If you extend it even a fraction of a second, you know you're dreaming or in some sort of microgravity.
But there's the rub, though, because your detection of reality is compromised when you're dreaming. It's like, right? That's the whole thing.
Well, but you're not going to read words, look away, and then read back and you're going to see the same words. They will change.
No, I agree with you. But what I'm saying is that
you're not going to
when you're dreaming. For the most part, all of these crazy things are happening, and it's not occurring to you that you're dreaming because your brain is not fully functioning.
Right. You need a certain level of lucidity just to think about doing that, that's true. But people that have good dream recall in general can kind of get in that state more often than people who can't. Some people just can't do it because they never really reach a level of lucidity where they can question reality.
That's right. I mean, what was quite funny with the Dream On app is because I was actually the main pilot for it. So and it's a very difficult thing with algorithms and the movement and how much the volume. So the thing is that as you start to move, it lowers the volume in the dreamscape and so on. Anyway, so I'm testing all this stuff. And so I'm sleeping with Caroline, my partner, who's a very light sleeper. And so I'd put this iPhone down for one night and I'd say, oh, we're doing a test tonight. And she'd go, oh, fine, and stuff. And then about, 3 a.m., it would zip on with, you are currently asleep.
Oh, my gosh.
You are currently asleep and you can control you. And she was furious. She was furious. And so I used to wake up with the iPhone in very interesting places. But but I'm quite a heavy sleeper, so I slept through the whole thing.
There's an app for that.
Yes. So she had a very tough time with it. But we think we've got it right now. It's not bad.
All right, so what's your ultimate goal here, though?
One is there's loads of research showing the mood you're in in the day is often set by your final dream. So you have a rough dream, and then you're in a bad mood. So it's slightly changed there. The other thing is I've really got into the literature on depression and dreaming. I didn't realize there's such a strong tie-up. So depressives dream about five times as much as normal people, as it were, non-depressives. And in their dreams, they're doing the same as they do in real life, which is ruminating. They're going over their problems time and again. So the idea of kind of going in and giving them a more positive dream experience is sort of an interesting one. It's quite curious.
Yeah. Controlling for medication with
therapy.
I know medications can give you, for depression, can give you really vivid dreams.
I don't know the literature well enough to answer that question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do they dream five times as much, or do they have five times better recall?
This will be coming from Sleep Labs, so I would think it would be about five times as much time in the classic REM
study. That's amazing. Right. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah.
There's also illusory insomniacs. So these are people that think that they're having a rough night's sleep. And in fact, you put them to a sleep lab and they're having a perfectly normal night's sleep, but they're dreaming about being awake.
Yeah. Oh,
it's the weirdest
awesome.
Thing.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I really got into dreaming and sleep. I think it's fascinating.
So I have a couple more questions because I'm totally blown away by what you just said about people that think that they're not sleeping well. What about people, if they think that they don't sleep well and they're also feeling tired during the day, but is there something about the quality of your dreaming that can affect your wakefulness?
Well, part of it is the emotional tone of the dream. So if you're having anxiety dreams, then, and particularly if you wake up directly from them, you just feel pretty bad. And so I just like the idea of trying to sort of tinker with it. And it's not my area of expertise, so I know the literature a little bit, but not especially well. And I guess what I bring to the party is the mass participation thing. I'm not afraid to roll this out to 500,000 people and to take risks. I'm sure a lot of sleep and dream researchers would go, well, that's all very fringy and weird. But I think, let's try it. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah.
And let's just be honest about the results. If it doesn't work, what's it matter? We've all had fun with it.
Yeah, that's cool. That's interesting. And just, just getting that many data points, you said millions of people.
Yeah.
I mean, something's got to emerge from that. It's interesting.
Over time, I love the fact that we can change the algorithms. We can change the dreamscapes. We're getting real-time reports back. And we might develop something. Who knows?
Do you know the term dream catcher, that was a reference to an Indian art form where they make these dream catchers that you...
Precisely. Stops bad dreams coming through the window. So we had that. And we're developing a new app which spins off of the one which I can't talk about. But so it's a big thing for me at the minute. It's taking up a lot of my time.
Very neat.
Good to have a hobby.
I think so. Yeah, it's good to have something you're interested in, right, other than pornography.
Well, before we go on to other... other news items, news items, we're going to do This Day in Skepticism. Evan, you're taking over since Rebecca's not with us tonight.
Yep. So this show is going to air on November 24th. On November 24th, in 1859, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, Darwin's groundbreaking book was published in England. Familiar with that, Richard?
England, yes.
Yes,
I've heard of it.
Once or twice. The British naturalist Charles Darwin detailed the scientific evidence he had collected during his voyage on the Beagle in the 1930s, and he presented his idea that species are the result of gradual biological evolution in which nature encourages, through natural selection, the propagation of those species best suited to the environment, or their environments, I should say. He had been prompted to publish it at the time by Charles Lyell, L-Y-E-L-L. And he was the one who advised him that Alfred Russel Wallace, who was also a naturalist, he was approaching the same conclusions. He was about to get ready to publish his own results. And he said to Charles, hey, you better get on the stick here. You're going to wind up in second place in this contest.
Yeah. Well, what happens with Wallace being a younger, maybe naive researcher, sent his manuscript to Darwin to say, hey, am I onto something here? Am I crazy? You know, what do you think about this? And then Darwin was like, this is, I'm just, a, you know, he saw that this guy had, was ready to scoop him on the thing he's been working for decades on.
Yeah.
And it was his friend who said, do it. So they presented both papers at, I think it was the Royal Society.
Right. Right.
And they made sure that Darwin's paper went first.
Yep. And on day one of the publication, they printed as many copies as they did, and it sold out immediately. It was an instant success and hit. And, you know, sort of the rest is history from there. The controversy of creationism and all that.
It's amazing how much Darwin got right. You know, I mean, such a huge idea, you know, evolution through natural selection. And if you read back, and you can actually now, you can get the whole book online for free. So if you want to read any part of The Origin of Species, you can get to it. He really thought through a lot of different things that about the evolutionary process. And obviously he didn't get everything right. We've come a long way since Darwin in terms of evolutionary theory. But, he gave a huge start to that field. Usually you have these sort of fledgling, like a new scientific discipline will start out with just some ideas and it's very preliminary. But he did spend a lot of time developing his theories to a pretty advanced degree before then publishing it. So the whole, you know, evolution through natural selection thing hit the ground running in a way.
Hit the ground running, definitely. Yeah. Definitely
he also
did
lots of work on facial expressions, of course, as well. So you put electrical currents into an alcoholic's face and get and contort his face into various expressions, take photos. And then when people came around to visit him in his house, he would show them the photos and they had to guess the expression. He was looking at reliability of facial expressions.
Wow.
Apparently it really hurts to have electric current applied to your face.
Which is why yeah, right?
They used alcohol. Yeah, it's true. It's why he used an alcoholic, because he couldn't feel the pain.
Did you make that up?
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true.
Wow.
Yeah. I found out some trivia. Do you want some David Hume trivia?
Sure.
Oh.
So David Hume, the sort of founder of, in some ways, skepticism and humanism and so
we
on.
We quote him frequently.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So I live in Edinburgh, for a lot of the time. And Hume was in Edinburgh, two streets away from where I live. And so I thought I'd go and see his house. So I went round and his house is there. And the funny thing is that the part of Edinburgh it's in is called the New Town, which was built in the Enlightenment. And so all the streets have got very kind of modern names, as it were. There's no old names like Saint whatever, except the street he's in, which is St. David's Street. So what the council did, because they didn't like him because he's an atheist, when he moved into the street, they renamed the street St. David's Street after him, as in St. David Hume. So every time he had to give the address, he had to write St. David.
St. David.
So they actually renamed the whole street just to annoy him. Mm-hmm. I think that's great.
Badge of honor.
Yeah. How annoying would you be, though, if you move into street as an atheist and so on, they rename the whole street after you but give you a sainthood. So there we are. That's my little bit of trivia. It's not much, but
awesome.
It's something.
That's awesome. No, that's it.
Fascinating.
All right. Well, the first news item we're going to talk about is...
I've got a dead dog in my garden. I've got a dead dog in my garden. I moved into this house...
And now you're just fucking with us.
No! I'm not. I haven't got my iPhone with me. Otherwise, I'd show you not the dog. So I moved into this house. We moved into this house. We had to move out of the old house because Caroline wasn't sleeping very well there. And
something to do with the iPhone.
Every single morning.
Yeah.
So it comes with a little bit of garden, which is very unusual right in the middle of town. And it's covered in ivy. So I go out to cut down the ivy, being the manly chap that I am. And it's very difficult. We ever try to cut ivy and get rid of it?
No.
You need a machete.
It's hard. Works. It grows into the ground and everything. So I'm working away, and I hit my foot on something. I look down, and it's a gravestone for a dog. I've got a dead dog in my garden.
Oh, so wait, how did you know it was a gravestone for a dog and not something else?
Because it said on it.
This is a gravestone for a dog.
Yeah.
Okay. No, well, then there you go.
Yeah.
So did you dig it up?
I'm going to dig up a dead dog.
Why not?
It's 200 years old. The
gravestone's
cool. 200 years old.
Oh, that is awesome.
So I've got a dead dog that's 200 years old in my garden.
That is so English.
It's Scottish. Believe me, you will.
It is? Okay.
You're not making that mistake.
Scottish Terrier.
Yeah, it's very Scottish. So I've got a dead dog in my garden.
I have a dead dog story, too. So I was visiting my wife's mother with my two daughters. for some holiday a few years ago. And we were exploring in the backyard because they have lots of shale. And so every now and then you could find a little fossil leaf or something in the shale. And we came across a skull of some kind of animal. Ooh. And then over there was a rib. And then here was something else. So we gathered all the bones. It took us like an hour to find as many bones as we can. We laid them all out together. And then I started going through pictures to figure out what it was. And I eventually figured out it was a dog. Then I got the story that
you laid out the bones.
Well, I put them into the position.
How old are your daughters?
She was like 10 at the time, 9, 10. They're good with that. Trust me. No, my daughters have had
paleontologists.
They're all nerded up and they're good with
nerded
the whole
up is strange.
Macabre thing. My younger daughter loves her Uncle Bob, loves Halloween. Her favorite colors are orange and black.
Awesome.
She already has picked out her favorite weapon for in case of a zombie apocalypse. Mm-hmm. She's good.
It's like living in another world, isn't it?
Love it. So anyway, we figured out it was a dog. And it was the exact size of a dog that my mother-in-law owned that had died. Like,
oops.
20 years previously, 15 years
so
previously.
So you dug up your family's dead
dig
dog.
Dig it up. I didn't dig it up. This is what happened. The dog just vanished one night and they never found it. And it was sick. And I think the thing just went away to die. But it was like right in over the hill in the backyard. So they didn't realize that the dog had died like 50 feet from the house.
Oh my God. Talk about lazy. Like they didn't explore the woods right around the house.
It was in the woods right outside the house.
That's pathetic.
So I solved that mystery for them. I solved that 20-year-old lost dog.
So your daughters would have gone to school and they would say, what did you do at the weekend? And I say, Daddy reassembled a dead dog.
Yes. Yes.
We didn't reanimate it or anything. You know, just a frightened weenie. Yeah, right.
Well, this brings me to one of the biggest mysteries. Well, there are two things. Can I tell my dead dog joke? This won't work, except here. So a man's driving along and he knocks over a dog. And so he thinks, oh, that's terrible. So he goes and knocks on the house nearby and he says, I think I just knocked over your dog. And they say, well, what did it look like? And the guy goes, well, it's kind of. And the person said, no, I meant before you knocked it over. And so the guy goes, well, I think it was kind of. So anyway, what I'm wondering.
Those are great visual jokes for a podcast.
Yes. I realize now the error of my ways. Yes. But you can tell from the laughter in the room just how good that joke was.
It's playing well.
I occasionally go into the countryside. I don't know if you like the countryside, but I occasionally go out there. It's full of animals. Where are all their bones? Mm-hmm. Where are all the cow bones or the fox bones?
Right.
Where do they're big they're boned there. Animals. They're not.
They get eaten?
I don't know. That's dragged a genuine away. Question. I haven't got an answer. Yeah. Like, you take a horse. That's a big boned animal. It'll take years for that thing to degrade or whatever it does.
Scavengers. Do break up the bones and eat the bones.
When you say scavengers, you mean people... Birds. Like Steve, who goes along and reassembles it. Hey, kids, stop! There's a horse over there, so take me a time, but I'll put it all right. No, scavengers, foxes.
I don't know if foxes are scavengers, are they? I thought they hunt like...
What's a scavenger, then?
In England? What's a scavenger in England? Well, probably vultures.
Wolves.
We don't need vultures.
Irishmen. I don't know.
Oh! Don't come and visit. Not after that line. Irishman. Fantastic.
The day I cracked Richard up. It is a
good question, though. Okay, but let's start with the logical idea that something is happening to them because you're right. They're not piled up high, knee high in
the
woods.
I have never seen a skeleton of a horse or a cow in the country. Yeah,
but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
I saw a skeleton of a deer once when I was walking through the woods. More than once.
Okay.
Yeah, but okay,
for what it's worth,
but not hundreds of them. You see hundreds.
Yeah. I've gone hiking dozens and dozens of times in very heavily populated woods, as far as animals are concerned. And I very, very infrequently will I find a skull of something or whatever. It's like you'd figure, there'd be a lot of bones kicking around.
Precisely.
Nobody and people. I'm sure that people aren't picking them up.
Do you look? Do you like really make a concerted effort to look?
It could be like your dog. Maybe they go and hide.
Yeah.
50 meters away from where they were last
20
seen.
Years, 15 meters, feet, not even meters, and they didn't find it.
That's just weird.
Well, yeah, it was kind of over a little hill under, it was probably in
whatever,
the
bushes. Steve.
We measure things in feet.
I was right. Surprised. Was I'm not defending. I'm just saying. But, yeah. So I think it's partly they bones don't last for long in the wild.
No, they do. They last bones. You can dig up a human skeleton a couple hundred years later and it's
yeah,
still.
Yeah, but that's not sort of just out in the open. It's under the ground. That's a big difference.
No, if you put a horse skeleton on a field, it would be there for, must be tens of years.
I don't know.
Many wild horses in England?
Yeah, they're furious, a lot of them.
Really?
They are, yeah. No, we have horses, we have deer, we have cattle. I have never seen, like, a, you know, skeleton of one. Something odd.
You're saying
happen.
This is what a genuine mystery.
That, Steve?
It's a genuine mystery which we need to, it could be the Irishman. That's the only.
So the conventional answer that I'm familiar with is that it's scavengers. I don't know what scavengers are in England. We could look that up, but.
Crows? Crows.
Well, crows definitely.
Birds.
Yeah.
But some, the horse is a big thing.
Some scavengers eat bones. I mean, they actually break up the bones and get the marrow and destroy it. But I don't know, which ones would still be extant in England.
Maybe animals bury their dead and we're just not aware of it?
No.
Is that possible?
Maybe invisible psychic teleporting Bigfoot. Take care of the bones.
Yeah.
That's an explanation, all right.
But that argument comes up with Bigfoot because we say, well, why don't we find any Bigfoot remains? And people say, well, you don't find remains of animals out in the wilderness. And to an extent, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So why don't we, you know, do some research and we'll revisit this one.
Okay. Well, we are going to move on to some news items.
Well, any other non sequiturs,
yeah,
Richard?
You have like any other interjections? Well, Richard,
you know, the other application that Richard was developing that he didn't want to mention is called the Porn Catcher.
The Porn Catcher?
Yes.
He's working on that
yeah,
with you.
It's what it is, it's a app that asks people to send him the link to their favorite porn.
Yeah.
And he analyzes all this. Psychologist.
Over and over.
I'm just chatting. You don't want
so
me
there
to
was
chat.
There was a recent study published on aspartame. Now, aspartame is an artificial sweetener. It's been very controversial since the internet, you know, because people believe that aspartame is to blame for all sorts of horrible things because it ain't natural, right? But it's been widely studied. Hundreds of published studies about it, and in fact, it's perfectly safe. And not just the FDA, but multiple organizations, the WHO, and certainly in the UK and in Europe, have reviewed the data on aspartame and have concluded that there are no health risks when the product is consumed as intended. They always say, which means I guess you're not eating buckets and buckets of it, but you're just using it as a sweetener. But there was a recent study looking at the incidence of lymphoma and leukemia in men and women drinking sugary sodas versus artificially sweetened drinks. And the study concluded that there was a slightly increased risk in men only but not women who drank soft drinks sweetened with aspartame for leukemia and lymphoma. The Brigham and Women's Hospital put out a press release. The title of the press release was "The Truth Isn't Sweet When It Comes to Artificial Sweeteners." An irresistible pun, right? Mm-hmm. Promoting this study. Within, I think it was just a couple of days later, they retracted their press release. They essentially said to the media, "This is actually a rather weak study. We apologize for wasting your time. Please ignore our previous press release."
Is that unprecedented?
I don't know if it's unprecedented. It's good that they did it.
It's good that they
surprisingly
retracted
good.
It. So, has the damage been done, though?
The damage is done. But what happened was, the press office was looking for news to put out, and so one of their researchers was involved with this study, and they put out the press release. But we've talked about this before, the notion that there's always a lot of this research going on in the background, you know, biomedical research in every field. Most of it's crap or preliminary or the kind of data that's only interesting to other researchers in terms of an area and perhaps of further research. And really, There's you have no business promoting the results of this study to the public. It's not that you're trying to hide it from the public, but it's just not it does not rise to that level of public interest. It's just too preliminary. And essentially, they were called on this, and they acknowledged that, yep, this is, you know, this is not the kind of study that should be in a press release to the public, because the data was exceedingly weak. And I looked over it, and it is an extremely weak study. The correlation was very small, easily the kind of thing that could be due to chance alone.
It is, you know, not in line with other research, which shows that there is no increased risk from any of these things from consuming diet soda. It was only in certain subgroups, you know, only when you're looking at the data in a certain way. So it was not robust at all.
Presumably, you also got a correlation causation issue, even if it is a
genuine effect. Even if the correlation is true, it doesn't show you that there's a causation there. So, but it's interesting because this is some the kind of thing that often, like we do all the time, is you get either a press release or something gets, you know, in the news cycle. It's a really preliminary crappy study, and it is getting blown out of proportion or overhyped or scaremongering in this case. So it's interesting that they did it to themselves, where they sort of withdrew and said, whoops, we really shouldn't have done that. Sorry, this was not an appropriate study. I wonder what the backstory is on that, how that really happened.
Yeah. Like, you mean they didn't do it with good intentions? Maybe they were forced to do it?
I bet you. Well, I don't know. I'm just inferring that, you know, something – it's possible that the researcher himself contacted the press office and said, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
This is not the kind of study that we want to go shouting around to the public. This is a preliminary study with very soft findings. It's not worth it. Maybe he was, you know, worried that he would get embarrassed by it or something. But it's interesting. You know, I wonder how much of this kind of thing is due to the internet, you know, the web, because there is there's this news cycle, and then there's often a blogging cycle immediately after that, where you have a lot of science bloggers who know what they're talking about criticizing the media for misrepresenting studies, and the media is paying attention to that. I get contacted all the time by journalists or outlets who are responding to the backlash to the original horrible reporting about stories.
You know, if that's true, Stephen, why aren't things getting better?
Yeah, well, you know, it certainly subjectively it seems that way. I mean, I don't know that we're actually tracking it in any kind of objective way, but I think there are bright spots, you know. But overall, you know, the media reporting is getting worse, it seems, and I think the conventional wisdom is that it's essentially the collapse of the business model of journalism because of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But there are good reporters out there, and I do think that they're increasingly getting on to the idea that scientists can directly bypass them and write to the public and write blogs, et cetera. And that if they, you know, if they want to be relevant, remain relevant, they got to stay on board with that. Otherwise, they're just going to be blog fodder, you know, for scientists who are blogging directly.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, but going, the aspartame thing comes up frequently. You know, I don't think we've really tackled it thoroughly on the show before, but it's one of those urban legends, the idea that aspartame causes all these horrible things. The primary thing, the claim about aspartame now is the whole formaldehyde angle. Have you ever heard about this, Richard? One of the breakdown products of aspartame is formaldehyde, and they sort of link formaldehyde to all kinds of horrible, you know, diseases and outcomes. But
so wait, Steve, to clarify, when you digest aspartame, part of the digestion process converts it to formaldehyde formaldehyde.
Yeah, it's one of the metabolic breakdown products. But it's just like a lot of things, you know, a lot of foods that we eat gets broken down into formaldehyde along the way to its ultimate, you know, breakdown products. But it insignificantly contributes to the amount of formaldehyde in your body and doesn't have any harm associated with it.
And it's normal and natural.
It's part of normal metabolism. So, but you know, you tell people, oh, aspartame gets broken down to this horrible, dangerous, scary sounding chemical, and then the fear mongering goes from there. So, Jay, you're going to tell us next about why it's fun to be a psychopath.
Yeah, it's not just why it's fun to be a psychopath. It's more examining aspects of what psychopaths have at their disposal and how maybe the average person can learn something from it. But they did this was written in a playful way. So we have a British psychologist at the University of Oxford named Kevin Dutton, and he asked a question: would we be better off as psychopaths? And
Do you know this guy?
Oh, I know Kevin. Yeah.
You do.
Yeah.
I don't think that he's actually saying. He was not being like honest, saying yes, I think we're going to be better off as psychopaths. He's just using it playfully to start a talking point here.
Well, he's got a new book out, hasn't he? Called The Wisdom of Psychopaths.
Yeah, he does.
That
might
be behind his question.
That's very true.
You think? Remarkable coincidence.
Psychologists promoting their own books?
What? It is disgusting.
So
I thought there was only one.
So he states, and this was funny. This article that we're referencing. The actor that plays Dexter,
Michael C. Hall.
Yeah, I always confuse him with that other
Anthony
actor.
Anthony Michael Hall.
Yeah. Yes, I do.
They were interviewing the author of the book named Dutton, and and the actor, and they were like chit-chatting about it. And it was interesting to hear some of the things that that the guy that plays Dexter was saying about what it's like to play that character and everything. What Kevin Dutton is saying here is that someone, a psychopath, they lack empathy, they lack compassion, they don't really have a conscience. And these are the things that directs most of our actions, right? So we're limited by the social constructs in our head. Very interestingly, he said that dumb, extremely impulsive psychopaths often end up dead or in prison. However, he said that the other psychopaths can thrive if they're smart and if they're disciplined, which is a very interesting thing to observe. So in the end, he mentions that that being a psychopath is on the spectrum. It's like autism. Like there's extremely psychopathic all the way to, you know, normal people, right? And there's all these infinite shades of gray.
I can't say normal, Jay.
Oh, Christ. Okay. So he's saying that the spectrum is there from an extremely psychopathic
psychotypical
person. All right. Psychotypical. Want me to start over?
No, I'm okay. Semi-joking.
Okay.
But there's the neurotypical movement in terms of talking about things like autism and other recognized neurological disorders.
Okay.
It's kind of a huge aside. Maybe Richard can tell me what he thinks about this, if this is also happening in the UK. The notion that it's very hard to say in terms of human psychology and behavior and even just how our brains are hardwired, what's quote unquote normal, as if anything outside of that, those parameters are abnormal. Sometimes we talk about healthy and unhealthy, or we talk about people who have disorders, defined as something that's causing a definable problem. You know, there are people who very seriously advocate saying things like, well, autism is not a disorder. It's just, they're just different than the neurotypical, arrangement of neurons. So I was just sort of playing off of that. And I wonder if, people would get upset at saying that psychopaths are abnormal or unhealthy. Maybe we should call non-psychopaths psychotypical.
Whatever. Coming from a non-professional.
Does this kind of political correctness occur in your...
It's bullshit. Well,
before we get to that, I should point out, so that your listener can join in with this, if they search for sexy goat, they will get a sheep wearing women's clothing.
It's good to know.
Which is what I just did a few moments ago on your iPad. Where do I stand on the normal thing? Funny enough, I actually did it earlier on in the podcast, actually, because I said depressives and normal people, and then I changed it to non-depressives. I think it depends. If you've got somebody who's deeply strange, who's a proper psychopath, who's genocide, murdered millions of people, and doesn't give a monkey's, I'm happy to call them abnormal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you go, I don't know. Is political correctness gone mad?
Yeah.
I remember the days when... used to use the word guinea pigs, now you have to call everyone participants.
Yeah.
Did the guinea pigs get upset?
They did. They did. They sued. Class action. Who knew? I was nearly sued by a gorilla.
the one that walked through with the basketball?
No. I was writing Quackology, and Coco the gorilla is... can sign language.
Uh-huh.
And so she was the first gorilla to take part in an AOL live chat, interspecies chat. Mm-hmm. So people put questions and Coco signed the answers. And I quoted some of the chat in my book, but I didn't clear the copyright. I was approached by Coco's representatives, who said that you haven't cleared it. And I said, hold on a second, you don't own that copyright. Coco does. And so if she wants to sue me, I'm happy to go to court.
That's right.
About it. Because I wanted to be sued by a gorilla.
Have her hire an orangutan. Have her hire an orangutan.
That's awesome. It would have been the best thing ever to be sued by a gorilla. Because I thought the judge may sort of give two bunches of bananas and damages.
Now that's not politically correct.
Do they even eat bananas with gorillas?
I think so. They're vegetarians.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's my idea about panda branding. I had this idea. I think I mentioned this, is that zoos, Edinburgh, we've got pandas, and financially are struggling. And I had the idea of using the white space on the panda as kind of advertising space.
A billboard.
Yes. Yeah. And you could spray on something, beetroot juice or something, into the Nike kind of like logo or whatever. And that would be advertising space. But oh, no.
All right. So I'm going to agree with Richard. I'm going to agree with Richard on the whole. Like, there are people that have mental disorders, and some of them are called psychopaths. And then there are people that we consider to be normal.
Non-psychopaths.
No, but why is the word normal bad? That's ridiculous.
It's just very hard to define.
The average person,
typical.
Typical. Yeah. Okay. All right. And every kid wins an award and nobody wins. Yeah. Whatever. Right.
I know, Jay. So, I know it's tough. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah. I'm not a scientist or a doctor and yeah. I can be stupid.
We know
I'm
it's
just
lame.
Not as educated as you. So anyway, I don't even remember where the fuck I was now.
So
Dutton is describing psychopaths, and he says that they tend to be fearless, ruthless, capable of extraordinary focus. They're cool and decisive under high-pressure situations that non-psychopathic individuals would tend to be anxious.
So they're like Animal Mother from Full Metal Jacket. They're great in a war. Like, what do they say? All he needs is somebody to throw grenades at him for the rest of his life. But in normal society.
No. Hold on. This is very good. It's interesting. And he continues to say that they're very good at reading other people's facial expressions and manipulating people's emotions and taking advantage of things they perceive about that person. They have a better than average ability to detect when people are lying and where they're emotionally vulnerable.
Yeah. Which,
you know, I'm not sure of how accurate this is, but it sounds very interesting.
How did you find that out?
How did he find it out?
Yeah.
It's in his book. I don't know. He wrote a book.
But you'd need a group of psychopaths and a group of non-psychopaths and then give them a lie detection task.
I think you're – well, and I don't even trust lie detection. I don't think those lie detector machines are that accurate.
Well, no, but even if you're just showing them videos and saying spot the liars, it seems a bit of a strange study. Has that been done?
Apparently he did do some studying on this.
Really?
So then he goes on to say that there are psychopathic traits found in CEOs, lawyers, media personalities, special forces soldiers, and surgeons. It's a pretty impressive list, a very accomplished list, very list where you would think that the people are intelligent. And he's making a claim that they have some psychopathic traits, and he thinks that those traits are the things that make them give them the ability to be successful in these areas. I found that to be a little disturbing. But it also is very provocative. You know, if you think about it, if our sanity is on a spectrum, if we have all these levels that we could measure ourselves by, and you put, you know, being a psychopath in there and say, okay, you know, how psychopathic is someone? You know, maybe the first 5% of it isn't so bad for you, you know, or whatever.
Well, that's
right?
Probably true of most things, you know, psychologically, is that there's a survival advantage, you know, to certain traits, and they still exist. You know, the more extreme ones still exist because the milder versions are adaptive. And certainly, the ability to be cool and fearless and ruthless when necessary, I mean, it seems pretty obvious how that could be, you know, have a survival advantage. And in order to keep the genes for those traits around, every now and then you can have a psychopath. You know what I mean? Evolution is messy.
What worries me, I mean, I like Kevin a lot and I'm sure the book's great, but what worries me about this sort of thing is that it seems to me you get a bestseller, a popular book, by simply taking common sense and just arguing the opposite. So you think, well, being a psychopath is bad, and now you say that's good. But that just seems to me a formula for a bestseller or a popular book. So if you took Buddhism, the book could be Why Buddhism Will Kill You.
Yeah, right.
And so it's just a very well-worked formula, which is why it's a good talking point, is that it turns out it's the exact opposite, how puppies are evil.
Yeah.
Well, like it's like Kevin Trudeau, you know, everything that the government doesn't want you to know, you know, like that type of...
But your doctors won't tell you.
Yeah.
I would hope that the title of the book or the provocative entry point that the author has created isn't rampant throughout the book. Like, you know, maybe that's just the eye catcher that gets people to buy it.
The hook. Yeah.
But it is an interesting idea. You know, it's just, to me, it's a thought experiment. What do you think about that? You know, there are, being that these types of conditions, you know, it's all subjective. Well, maybe that's not the right term. It's, you know, how do you gauge these things? Like, how psychopathic is someone?
There's a psychopath test.
Right. Kind of like the test.
Remember we talked about John Ronson wrote a whole book about it. We interviewed him about it.
Yep.
And then you get a number. You're 28, you know, or whatever. If you're over a certain number, then you go to prison for the rest of your life.
What do you mean if you get...
If you are arrested for committing a crime and they give you the psychopath test and you score over a certain number, then you get in the booby hatch for the rest of your life. Because you are deemed a danger to society, and good luck ever getting out again.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I didn't remember that.
You should read John Ronson's book.
I probably should.
It's a very good book. The my most psychopathic group I've worked with, stand-up comedians.
Wow. Is that right?
I think they're a bunch of psychopaths. And if you listen to the language they use when they talk about their audiences, it shows they got killed tonight. I slayed them. Really aggressive language. I don't give a monkeys about anyone.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. There you go. It's official.
So
if a stand-up comedian ever kills, they should be locked up for the rest of their lives.
But Richard, do you think that part of their ability to be funny comes from that?
Well, mine?
clearly, yes.
No, I'm a very caring person.
Yeah,
and not particularly funny. But if you actually meet somebody who is funny, no, I think it is. I think there's a ruthlessness to comedy, stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And which is why they're getting the horrible sort of picking on people in the audience and all of that. But I honestly think for the most of them, they absolutely could not give a monkeys about their audience at all. Their humor doesn't come from a nice place.
Right. Okay.
Which is why they're all so weird.
Yeah. I've had some experience. I've gotten to know comedians, and I have to agree with you. I think that, like what you're saying, there's a note in there that I can agree with. It's that the psychopathic thing about them is that they actually just don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Which is kind of scary when you're talking to someone. They just feel like whatever tomorrow, whatever. I don't even know where I'm going to be. I agree with you.
There we go.
We're going to change pace a little bit here. We're going to get away from the social sciences for a moment. Bob, you're going to tell us something about supernova.
Yeah. This news item caught my attention. I found it very interesting. There's a new idea, a new theory or model for the progenitors of a very special class of supernova, a supernova 1A. I don't know how many people have heard of this type of supernova. If you're not familiar with it, it might not be what you think, because when you think supernova, you think a sun explodes, a star explodes, and it's usually a supergiant star. But these are actually different. Supernova 1A type of star or explosion happens when a white dwarf, which is a burnt out ember of a star, when it accretes matter from a stellar companion that is in orbit, they're in orbit around each other, and when this matter is siphoned off and gathers on the white dwarf, it reaches a certain critical threshold, and it just, the outer layer of this white dwarf just explodes into a supernova, a giant explosion. These are very special supernovas because they're standard candles. So everything about it is based on laws of physics that are pretty much invariable, so that the explosion, no matter where it is pretty much identical, right? So, by examining these types of supernovas, you can determine how far away it is. So it's a standard candle of distance. And this was really huge in the news. I think it was in 1998 when they found that using this type of supernova as a standard candle, they determined that the universe is not only expanding, but it's expanding at an ever-increasing rate, expanding faster and faster and faster. And that brought in the whole idea of dark energy, which it looks like is the major constituent of the entire universe. So it was a huge discovery.
Who comes up with these words, though? I mean, if you discover something and you call it a white dwarf, it's a green elf.
Yeah.
Green elf. I got a pink pixie. Who comes up with these things? Is there someone who decides what is and isn't acceptable?
You mean, is there a committee for the naming of...
There is. The International Astronomical Union.
So you go up to them and you say, I've come up with this idea and I'm going to call it a turquoise elf.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, no.
Right. That's exactly
ridiculous.
Correct.
Yeah.
You can have a white dwarf, no further. The thing is so arbitrary.
They're red giants as well.
Red giants.
Red giants and
they
white
just want
dwarfs.
Things that
white
sound dwarfs. Impressive. Don't
black
they?
Holes.
Yes. Black holes, yeah.
Got a slightly effeminate elf. Quite like the idea of a slightly effeminate elf. Oh, hello.
Like I'm sure the Keebler elves, I think, all fit that description.
The what?
The Keebler elves.
They make the cookies.
Stare from the
they
bread.
Live in the
nothing.
Tree and make cookies.
Make cookies. It's
in
one of the. It's
in
one
America.
Of the.
Richard is looking puzzled.
Biscuits. We call them biscuits.
No, that wasn't the bit of it I was querying. Out of that sentence, it wasn't the cookie bit I was querying. It was the elves in the trees. There's a mythical creature.
Yeah.
That lives in a tree.
And makes cookies.
And makes cookies.
The Keebler elves.
The Keebler elves.
It's not really mythical. It's more of a marketing.
Right. I see. The Keebler thing is a brand or something.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now you're getting it.
Isn't that
apparently
so weird?
Not in the UK.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's so weird to like something that I've been seeing my entire life since I was a kid, and you look, it's like you live in another country.
Yeah.
We know each other, and you're like, no fucking idea what you're talking
no
about.
No idea at all.
It's so weird.
So would the astronomical committee allow a Keebler elf?
Potentially.
Can we brand these? That would be great.
This is the...
Because Nike, the... like, brand a black hole.
Yeah.
We call the Nike hole. Make some money.
Yeah. Well, you could create a fake organization and then sell the naming rights to things you don't have the right to name, and people will give you money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but why can't we go to the astronomical people and say, look, we've got a million from McDonald's, if we'll call it the McDonald's Nebula.
Yeah.
They'd take the money.
The McNebula.
McNebula.
McNebula. Yeah.
And you could order one. You could go into, I want a McNebula.
With cheese.
Yeah. And they go, you supersize it, and you go, it's already big enough.
I really don't want the corporate... You usually say corporate America. I don't want
corporate America out there in the universe. Oh, man. I think that'd be great.
One of my big ridiculous fears is that someone's going to create a laser that's powerful enough to cast advertisements
on the moon. Yeah,
I don't want to look up and see like
Coca-Cola
billion-dollar advertisements in the sky.
I don't want that, but I think they should be able to name things. I think that would be all right.
If they gave an amazing amount of money.
Well, sure. That's
KFC.
That reminds me of a short story, science fiction short story I read really quickly, where our first contact with aliens, and they come in, they offer us some international currency. I forget what it was. Not international, intergalactic. You know, whatever. Yeah, Quatloos or whatever. And they wanted the right to do something in Jupiter. And they wouldn't exactly explain what it was. And we went along with the deal for whatever reason. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to plaster an advertisement across Jupiter. And they did it. They put some kind of laser effect or whatever. And it was in an alien language, so you couldn't understand what it said. But they wanted to use Jupiter as a bulletin board.
Go for
intergalactic bulletin board.
I think that's all right.
Yeah. I think it's good.
All right. I would go with that if everybody got rich, right? So now we're all rich.
And yeah, well, it was good for us, yeah. Yeah. Of course, it was probably like the beads to the Indians.
Right. Where are you going to spend these Quatloos?
You see, I think if aliens came down and visited us, and they would have to judge us, and the question is, would they judge our society because we'd found a white dwarf somewhere? Or would they think better of us because we typed in sexy goat? And got a picture of a sheep wearing women's clothes. I put it to you that any alien worth its salt would go with sexy goat.
So that reminds me of another science fiction thing. This is a little short I saw on TV. It was Penn and Teller, where the aliens came down and they were going to destroy the Earth unless we had like 24 hours to prove to them that we deserve to live.
Yep.
You saw that one?
No, I haven't, but I'm with
you. I love it. It's awesome. Yeah. What was the series?
I don't know. It was some science fiction series.
Okay, go on.
And then Penn and Teller saved the planet by showing them the invisible string trick.
All right.
And they thought that was the best thing. That if we as a species could be entertained by the invisible string trick, we deserve to live.
I think sexy goat is better.
Sexy goat is better.
What happens when you put sexy goat into the world's greatest search engine? I think they'd respect that.
I think so.
But Steve, I think that, Douglas Adams, his idea that they wanted to put a super intergalactic highway through, that's more likely than,
So Bob, what's the new bit with this supernova?
You know, when I prepare these news items, I try to anticipate tangents that we can go on and have fun with. I never would have thought of McNebula or Sexy Go. I never would have thought of that.
You lack imagination.
Yeah. I'm lacking something.
Richard.
Shut up.
A company could name one of the oceans, KFC.
Oh, that's good.
KFC
would be fantastic. We should let them do that for money.
We should.
Like the Atlantic or something. How much would we charge them? I'm flying over KFC.
Yeah.
All right, so there's two problems. You remember what I was talking about? Because I don't. There's two problems with this kind of supernova, though. You've got the white dwarf. Everyone's pretty much agrees that there's a white dwarf in here, but there's something else in orbit. That are in orbit around each other. What is that thing? They're not really sure exactly what this thing is.
Isn't it just another sun?
But what kind? I mean, there's lots of different possibilities. There's the single degenerate model, which means that there's one degenerate star, which was the white dwarf, and there's a younger star, and it's siphoning matter off of that. So that's one possibility. The other one is a double degenerate model, and we have two white dwarfs that are around each other, and they collide.
They're feeding off each other.
Yeah, they're feeding off each other. They collide and create this titanic release of energy, something like that. But there's a problem with these two models. They don't match. When you look at the spectra of these supernovas, it doesn't match what these degenerate models say the spectra should be. They're looking at all the squiggles and they're not lining up, and there's a progression that it should match, and they're not matching up. So there's a problem with these ideas. So we don't know really what's going on over there. So this Craig Wheeler is an astronomer. He came up with a kind of a twist on the idea of this degenerate model. He's saying that it's a white dwarf and it's an M dwarf. It's called, is it M or W? It's an
M
dwarf.
Class M dwarf.
Which is a red dwarf. It's much more common. Very, red dwarf. Just lots of infrared heat. Very, very tough to see. Now, there's good reasons why this model makes a lot of sense. Red dwarfs are the most common star in the sky. If you look up in the sky, you're not going to see any of these because they're just too dim. But if you could see them, there's 70.
If you looked up at the sky, the most common star you won't see.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It's a red dwarf.
But if you could see them.
If you could see in the infrared better than the Hubble can, you would see it's 70% of the Milky Way is red dwarfs. I mean, so, all right, they're all over the place.
Now, why can't we see them?
Because they're too dim. They're too dim even for the Hubble.
But what if you took a boat way out on the KFC?
Yeah, okay, whatever.
Try to leave it in, Steve. He's not listening.
All right. So these are very common. White dwarfs are very common. So this is one of the ways that his theory is much more plausible. And there's also this other thing about the red dwarf being magnetic. And because it's magnetic, and if the white dwarf is magnetic, it would siphon this material much faster and create these supernovas. This is just an interesting idea he called it maybe Richard, you might like this. He calls it a white widow system.
Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. You know, Richard. Not to be mistaken with the black widow.
No, Richard, something no, else. Ridiculous.
No.
Yes.
This is a play on words on a black widow system, which is two neutron stars that annihilate each other, and that's called a black widow. So this guy thought it would be amusing to call this a white widow because it's a white dwarf.
That's not amusing. Should have known.
No, so that's
those whimsical astronomers.
Yeah, aren't they? So the interesting thing is that if we learn more about these 1A supernovas, and we might learn more about the standard candles, we might learn more about the expansion of the universe and dark energy, which I think would be pretty interesting.
Cool. So, what do we got next?
All right.
Whoa.
A little different. We're going to talk about fecal transplants. I know you guys' favorite topic.
Just a little different.
Richard was looking over my shoulder at my topic and made a very funny facial expression of disgust. Very common. Basic core human emotion, disgust. So one of the problems with antibiotics is that it wipes out your intestinal flora. It kills not just the bad bacteria, but it kills the good bacteria that keep your ecosystem
in balance. Do you ever do a good news story? Every time it's doom and gloom.
No, we're pretty much doom and gloom.
It is all doom and gloom.
But there's a happy ending in this.
It's about happiness.
Well, if there wasn't a problem, then we wouldn't need a scientific solution, right? You have to start with the problem. Problem is, you take antibiotics, it kills your good bacteria, and then you get bad bacteria take advantage of that situation, and you get an infection. And the most common and difficult one is Clostridium difficile, or difficile, C. difficile. And they're very difficult to treat, because what do? You give more antibiotics to kill that bacteria, but it's
compounding the problem.
It's potentially compounding the problem. So it's tough. It's a very difficult problem.
But
in hospitals.
Of course, this doesn't happen to everybody.
No, but it's common. It's really, really common, I'm telling you.
Tell me what happens when you get that. Like, do you feel sick?
You have diarrhea. Yeah. You imagine you're in the hospital sick with something, you're getting antibiotics. Now, on top of that, you got horrible diarrhea. And then you have to go into isolation, because if you weren't already, because you got C. diff and we can't, And then everyone has to glove up when they go in to see you now. So it's a big problem. And one of the approaches to treating that is there anything we could do to reestablish or restore or support the gut bacteria to help fight the C. diff infection? Mm-hmm. And there's been lots of studies with probiotics, right? You take the yogurt with the bacteria in there, and can that decrease the C. diff infections? And the data on that is pretty weak. The answer is generally no, maybe. In some studies where they use like the highest colony counts and early on, before it even sets in, maybe it helps a little bit, but it's not really the answer. You still have to take antibiotics to treat the C. diff. It's still a problem. One step beyond probiotics is a fecal transplant where they take a stool.
I think it's obvious.
Donation from a family member. Because
family has to be family.
Family members will tend to have the same ecosystem as you.
So but I thought your ecosystem was replaced by the bad stuff. That's the antibiotics killed it. Now some other crazy ass thing came in and took its place.
Well, it was there, and now it just goes out of control because the
balance has been lost.
Yeah, the normal flora is not keeping
it at
bay.
Okay, so you want to get people back to where they were.
Yeah, you want to give them back their ecosystem quicker, by giving them some bacteria. Now that the antibiotics are gone. So you give them a fecal donation from their family member that probably has the same ecosystem, same combination of bacteria. And it works. It does help.
All right. So question number one, what's the delivery mechanism?
You liquefy it. You dilute it in water, and then you give it through an NG tube down the nose. Into
does that mean no good tube? Because that's nasty. Nose?
Nasogastric tube, yeah.
They actually pump shit through your nose.
Yes.
Why don't they do it the other way?
Backwards?
It's because it's too close to the – you want to get it from the top so that it will work its way all the way through your system.
Oh, okay. So it's starting from the top of the stream. Okay. That's disgusting.
Everyone has that reaction. You know,
correctly so, they have that reaction.
Now, not to get graphic here, but are they pumping shit into your stomach?
Well, into the intestine.
So they actually go through
the stomach.
Past your stomach into your large intestine.
Yes.
Then they just do it.
Yeah, which is what we do most of the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wait. We meaning you've done this?
Physicians. Okay. I haven't done a fecal transplant, but I put NG tubes in people. So what they did a recent study in mice where they were looking at a fecal transplant, and they were trying to identify the bacteria that were most helpful. And they identified six bacteria in the Bacteroides and Lactobacillus species. And they found that giving these six species of bacteria was very effective in shortening and even curing the C. diff infections. So that's a good step forward. And what we were talking about, you know, before with the probiotics is that you give one or two different bacteria. It doesn't really help that much. You know, my favorite quote about that is from Mark Crystal, who said it's like planting corn in the rainforest. You know, you have an ecosystem. You're planting some corn is not going to change the ecosystem. But what if you give more? How many bacteria do you have to give? You know, how many different species do you have to give in what numbers before you are influencing the ecosystem? You are bringing back the normal flora. What they found is that six, you know, it may be enough. And if that's the case, their hope is that you can culture those six bacteria. You don't need a fresh stool sample. You just culture the six bacteria, and you could just literally give a pill with the bacteria in there, and not the fecal
much
down
better.
The NG tube. Yeah, much better.
And they can survive the gastric acids and
well, that's why you want it. Well, that's why you give it in the intestine, not the stomach. Some bacteria can survive gastric acids, but they're different than the bacteria that live in the intestine. So,
so how would a pill help that?
Well, because the capsule wouldn't dissolve until it's passed the stomach. Yeah. So this is a mouse study. It really was identifying the bacteria. So now, hopefully, they could develop like a probiotic type of treatment with those six bacteria. And in a pill form or something like that, you know, not having to require stool and still have the effectiveness on the C. diff infections. But that remains to be seen, right? That's now the next step in terms of researching this. But
I used to, in my younger days, I did quite a lot of research in India.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got Campylobacter.
That's nasty.
And so I had chronic diarrhea and I had to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took off. Well, as we were going along the runway, I thought, I need the bathroom.
Mm.
So I stood up. And the attendant said, quite rightly, you need to sit down. And I said, if I sit down, we're all going to regret this. And he realized what was wrong, and he let me in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I took off inside the bathroom as the plane climbed.
Angle, yes.
With chronic diarrhea.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
You don't want to be doing that.
Yeah, it's amazing how having a horrible biological event on an airplane makes it a million times worse.
A million times worse.
In retrospect,
I should have shut the door on the toilet. But. When I was in India,
before or after the siege of Juneau?
It was probably before, actually. This was 20-something, 26 years ago.
And you didn't get Guillain-Barré from that. You're lucky.
Oh, really? I don't know what that is.
that's a bad thing.
Maybe he does
have neurological
inflammation
disorder.
Of your nerves, and that's a bad form of it if you get it after a siege of Juneau infection.
Oh, right. No, yeah. It's fine. But anyway, so this is an interesting thing. So this is about 26 years ago in India. I'm sure it's changed now, but at the time it's a very, very poor country, and so they had to come up with a very novel solution some of the time, and this was the best one they ever came up with. The security guards, or I guess, I suppose it would be security, was to search your bags before you got onto the plane. And boy, they were thorough. They were really thorough. And I could not work out why they were so motivated, because clearly they weren't on very much money. And the answer was so brilliant. They got on the plane with you.
Hmm. Oh, I like it.
So they really cared. And this was a time when there was a lot of terrorism going on. So I thought it was a really interesting solution to motivation.
You had some skin in the game, huh?
Absolutely.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, we come up with some questions that are truthful, and one or maybe more which are not. I'm not going to.
Are you serious?
He's only been saying it for 380 episodes.
Oh, you want to say it again?
No, but I mean, one or maybe more. Are you serious?
Just, hey, I'm in charge of science fiction.
Do it, man.
All right. So we have a theme this week, and the theme is sharks.
Okay.
So I'm going to be telling you guys.
Shark Week.
I'm going to read off five shark facts. Five, and one of them is fake. The reason I went to five is there isn't like a big explanation for each one of these. Like, okay. You know, it's either true or
five.
Not. I have a little bit. Yeah.
Breaking new ground with that.
Is that impressive? That's impressive.
So, it's unprecedented, hence breaking new ground.
Right. Yeah. First one is, ready? Some sharks can change shape by inflating their bodies with water or air to make themselves bigger and rounder.
True.
Okay, so we need to explain to you how this game is played.
I have no idea what's
Jay's
going
to read all five items, and then we'll go one by one.
Oh, yes.
And then you can give your thoughts on all of those items and which one you think is the fake, is the fiction.
Okay.
Right, so hold your comments until we read all five, and it's your turn.
Do you have a game over here where you say it's like a letter, and it says, so what D is an animal, and you have to say dog?
No.
Yeah, we do that. No, we do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was playing at Christmas with my family once, and it came as a B, letter B, and it was the question was, what B turns women off? And the answer was body odor. My dad said blindness. And then went on to justify it throughout the entire Christmas day. It's horrible.
You're awesome. Okay, so... Second one.
It's true. My entire life's like this, you know. Nothing makes sense.
You are a cliche. You know that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I am. Honestly, it's the whole thing. I amuse myself endlessly all the time. I'd love it. Everywhere I go, I giggle. Yeah.
Some sharks' poop comes out in a spiral pattern.
True.
Steve, explain.
You'll go first.
Some sharks can vomit out their own stomachs.
True.
Number four. Sharks do not get cancer, which is why cancer researchers frequently study them. Five. Sharks are affected by the mood, leading them to kill more people. The moon. Now, do you want me to interact with the audience on this, Steve? Do you want to get their opinions?
Sure.
You guys, okay, I'm going to read the first one again. Before any of, other than Richard, who can't keep his mouth shut, we're going to talk...
You did invite me onto a radio show, so opening my mouth seemed to be a reasonable thing.
Some sharks can change shape by inflating their bodies with water or air to make themselves bigger and rounder. Who here thinks that's true?
No. The fiction.
Oh, who here thinks that's the fiction? Whatever.
Applaud, please.
Please.
If you think that's
applaud.
Fiction. Nobody.
Okay, everybody thinks that's true. Some sharks' poop comes out in a spiral pattern. Fiction. Okay.
This is just the audience, Richard.
Thank you.
Some sharks can vomit out their stomachs. Sharks do not get cancer, which is why cancer researchers frequently study them. Sharks are affected by the moon, leading them to kill more people. Okay. Now, Richard.
Oh, it's obvious.
Which one is the fake?
I would go with, not with the audience, but with the last one. I can't believe sharks are affected by the moon, causing them to kill more people. I think that's rubbish.
Gotcha. All the other, see how this is going to go quick. Okay, go ahead, Steve. Which one do you think is the fake?
You want me to go next?
Yeah.
The audience is correct. The sharks do get cancer. I am dubious about the moon one, but I strongly feel that the sharks don't get cancer one is fiction.
Evan.
You said, the last one, moon or moonlight?
The moon.
The moon. Okay. Then it's the cancer one. That's the fiction.
Bad.
I was thinking the moon, that didn't make much sense to me because for a full moon, extra light wouldn't matter because they don't really use their sense of sight anyway. It's all about, you know, they can detect, you know, parts per billion of blood or parts per million. It wouldn't matter. But the cancer one, yeah, I've read different things about it, but I think the current understanding is that they do get cancer, even though for years people thought they did not. So I'm going to go with the cancer one.
Okay, so I'll ask the audience again. Do you think the cancer one is the fake? Okay, there's three holdouts. There's thousands of people here, three people there. Okay. All right, so I'll just take them in order. The first one about some sharks can change shape by inflating their bodies with water or air to make themselves bigger and rounder. That is true. And it's very interesting. One of the sharks that can do this is called a swell shark.
Wow.
So creative.
And the reason why they do it is to prevent predators like seals and larger sharks from pulling them out of the rocky reefs where they live, or under ledges or crevasses.
Cool.
So the predator will come near them, and then they'll expand their body, so in essence making themselves impossible to pull out of that crevice.
Like a plug.
Yeah.
They wedge themselves in.
Yep. Yeah. They can suck the water in, and they significantly change the size of their body, which is very cool.
Option.
All right, the second weird one about some sharks' poop comes out in a spiral pattern. This one is very interesting. I learned a lot from reading this.
It's true.
Is it true?
Yeah, it's very true. A spiral valve in the lower portion of the intestine of some sharks, which is a modification of the ileum. Steve,
ileum.
You know that?
Ileum.
Yeah, thank you. It's my job to pronounce things wrong. This valve is internally twisted and coiled to increase the surface area of the intestines to increase nutrient absorption. But a few more things are very interesting about shark intestines. The shark intestines are much, much smaller than most mammals. Sharks have compensated for this by having it be a spiral effect, and what that does is it increases the surface area inside. And a couple of other things, the sharks can't pass large and hard objects like bones through their
yeah.
They can't absorb them. They can't break them down. So what happens is sharks will actually have a buildup of material in their stomachs, and they can actually invert their stomach and push all that stuff out. Now, sharks will do this for a couple of different reasons. Sharks will
Now you're getting to the next item.
No. I am, yes.
Yes. So it was funny when the first time you said sharks can vomit out their stomachs, my thought was, well, what else are they going to vomit out of their ass?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, because I actually, these two items are connected. So yeah. I'm going to.
But you meant they could vomit so that their stomach is outside their body.
They can actually vomit their stomachs out, meaning that they have muscles that will do it.
Turning a balloon inside out.
But check this out. Sharks don't, they do that, like I said, to expel matter that they can't digest. They also do it when they get anxious. And some predators go after the things that are in their stomach and not them. So they could actually have some legitimate food.
Mechanism.
Yeah. And they're actually pushing out food into the water, and then they swim away, and then a bigger predator will come and eat that.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a really, really cool evolutionary.
Well, maybe they need help with their intestinal flora, and that's why they're going after that.
It's like launching countermeasures.
It's countermeasures. Yeah.
The spiral, though, the internal spiral, how is that going to influence the spiral when it exits?
It's like, don't you ever watch Bugs Bunny when they shoot the cannon, they twist it, and the cannonball goes in a circle?
So why would it continue any spiral?
But that's not real?
Bob, it's literally, if you think about it, think about a spiral, right? And then there's the butt, and the poop comes out, and it just comes out in that spiral.
Oh, in the shape of a spiral.
Yeah, the poop comes
out. I thought it moved, not the shape.
No. It's shaped like a spiral.
I'm glad I misunderstood.
All right, so quite obviously, sharks do get cancer. The cancer thing started in 1970s when Henry Brehm.
So that was fiction.
That's fiction.
Fiction.
Henry Brehm and Judah Folkman.
I have taught the audience well. better than my brother, apparently. But read on.
These two guys from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine first noted that the cartilage prevented the growth of new blood vessels into tissues. And what happened was that study that they did led another doctor, Dr. I. William Lane, to write a book called Sharks Don't Get Cancer, How Shark Cartilage Could Save Your Life. What happened from the writing of that book is terrible. Because that guy wrote the book, 80% of certain shark species have been fished. And there's a lot of shark species that are on the brink of extinction because people are trying to eat
because shark cartilage became a snake oil treatment for cancer. In fact, sharks get cancer of the cartilage.
Right.
Yes.
So there's a lot of interesting information on that particular chain of events that led to people taking that as a supplement and everything, which I think I suggest that you read. There's a lot of interesting nuances in there that I found. But the end result is that ridiculous supplementation of animal body parts and whatnot causes a lot of damage. And then this is the other one I love. The sharks are affected by the moon, leading them to kill more people. I wrote that one kind of funny because I just wanted to be difficult. But they track shark movements. Scientists use devices to track where sharks go and when. And they observed that large congregations of sharks during specific lunar cycles have intensified feeding habits. And the other big thing is that depending on the phase of the moon, it pushes the sharks into shore because of the tide. So when these things combine, So the moon and the so these two effects basically have to coincide in order for it. So the moon has to be pulling the sharks in because of the tide, and the effect the sharks are affected by, I guess
the light?
I think it is the amount
really?
Of light. It makes them feed more intensely.
Interesting.
It doesn't happen that often, but when those two things kind of happen and then there's perfect people story. In the water, yeah, it happens.
Cool.
Jay, do you have a quote this week?
I have a quote sent in by a listener named
a quote in a minute.
Joseph Mignone. Mignone. He basically gave me how to pronounce his name, and I can't pronounce it. Mignone. Check out this quote. The aim of
he wrote it phonetically for Jay. I love it.
And it's, I still can't read it. The aim of science is not to open the door to infinite wisdom, but to set a limit to infinite error.
Here, here. Yeah, I agree with that.
And this was a quote sent written by Bertolt
agree with anything.
Brecht. Bertolt Brecht. Brecht.
Brecht.
Why don't you come here and yell his name? Seriously, come on.
Bertolt Brecht.
Bertolt Brecht.
Perfect.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much,
Richard.
Thank you, guys.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website. Or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.
Mine's always on vibrate, but you know what? I have a persistent sensation of vibration in my left hip where I have my phone. I always think my phone's vibrating when it isn't.
That's,
yeah.
We need a... Richard, who can we talk to about that?
You need an expert.
Any suggestions?
Steve, so you're saying that when things repeat themselves like that, your brain makes you feel it all the time?
Yeah, I mean, that's been described, actually, sort of phantom vibration.
Phantom, yeah, I've had it, too.
But
now it's very persistent. Because I've just had it on vibration for so long.
A form of tactile pareidolia?
Not pareidolia. It's a tactile illusion.
You're taking a vague sense and you're fitting it into a pattern that you expect or you're used to.
I just think that those nerves are just overstimulated.
Fantastic. Steve, you're in the shower. You hear the background noise of the water. And have you ever heard, is my alarm going off?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that a form of pareidolia?
Yeah, I hear that all the time.
This is kind of related to that, where you've got this vague stimulus that you're forcing into this.
I don't think it's
pattern.
A vague stimulus. I have a sensation of vibration on my hip.
Fascinating as this is, can we start?
Yeah. Well, who's just waiting for Evan?
Who says we haven't started? Wow.
Are we recording?
Of course we're recording.
Okay. Oh, we're recording. Was that it? I'm sorry. But seriously, were we recording?
But that doesn't count.
Yes,
that was just
the preamble. This is the preamble.
I see.
Okay.
I ruined it.
Here we go.
Not really.
So,
sure did.
What the hell is today? Today is Saturday, October 27th. Everyone ready?
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Nope.
Now he is. I'm joking.
All right. Ready, Evan?
Yes, ready.
Okay. Actually, I want room noise for 20 seconds. I'm sorry.
I guess that's a kind of room noise. Oh, Christ.
Oh, it's so juvenile.
So sorry. You're so sorry.